I'm Cody from Game Life Balance US, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other geeky podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hello there, everybody. My name is Sophie Aldred, and I had the enormously great pleasure of playing the character of Ace in Doctor Who. And I would like to just remind you that you are listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. It's not private, it's public. And it means that you, the public, can listen to this Gallifrey Public Radio. And I'm very honoured to be on it and interviewed by it. So I hope you really enjoy the interview with me and all the other amazing stuff that they put out. And thank you, thank you, thank you for supporting Doctor Who all these years and for all this time. Because without you, Doctor Who wouldn't be the show it is today.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry, if we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning. Welcome to episode 247 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where it's as if you're seeing that sibling that you butted heads with for years, you know, through all those knockdown, drag-out fights and the arguments over who had the better ideas or who had the right decisions, who chose the wiser paths, and suddenly, as they go off to live their lives somewhere far away, the realization hits you. Screw them. Good riddance to that jerk. No, I'm kidding. We kid here, of course. I am your host. My name is Kieran. Joining me, as always, in the GPR studios is my partner in time, Jay Witten. Jay, how you doing tonight?
I'm feeling especially clever tonight. Allow me to prove how clever I am.
Please do. Please do. Haley is not with us, but we have our guest this time around, who has been a longtime listener and friend of the podcast, whom for Federal Inquiry Protection Services, we will lovingly refer to for the remainder of the evening simply as Badger. Badger, welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio.
Hello there.
What's going on tonight, Jay?
So this week we're gonna take Moffat and put him under the microscope as we look closely at his legacy and the ways which he's moved Doctor Who as a program forward. He's been both commended and condemned, often by the same people, for years as showrunner. And in the speed of thought world of interconnectivity, the opinions of any viewer with a net-enabled device could and often were shared with either glee, malice, or a kind of weird mixture of both.
Right. It's funny. If you go back and you look at a lot of the bloggers, vloggers, and people who had a lot of the really, really loud, outspoken statements over the years, that many of them stepped back or retracted a lot of their early statements that they made around, you know, season 6, 7 or so, and realized that it was a matter of him sort of getting his footing and seeing how far he could reasonably push the envelope without really, really taking the show in some irreparable directions. I guess it's only fair, because it was sort of his point of entry into the Hooniverse, was to talk about his writing contributions. You know, we'll all point at Blink and, you know, say everything that we can about that and what he does with playing with paradoxes and such, or predestination and things of that sort. But just in general, I mean, as far as his contributions to the story of Doctor Who, both individual episodes or what he's done to move entire arcs forward, how do we feel about his writing style and how it has benefited the program?
You know, I've said on a number of occasions that Moffat episodes typically tend to be some of my favorite from whatever season they're in. So it I think that he is a spectacular writer. He has great ideas and knows how to execute them well. I've never really had any problem with his writing. So I'm just going to reaffirm the fact that he's probably one of my favorite writers on Who.
Okay. Badger, how do you fall on this?
I have to agree. I think he's created some of the most interesting characters. The angels were frightening. And I don't know. It's just he's always been kind of that clever, is the word that's always used, kind of writer that he likes to play with time. He likes to play with fear.
Mm. It seems to go to a lot of base reactions with people. And I think that's one of the reasons why, and Jay, I mean, how many times have we said that when it comes to pulling at heartstrings or speaking to raw emotion, there's nobody that you'd probably go to faster for doing that sort of thing. But I think that's because he works in basics and he builds on them quite elaborately. But a lot of times you can boil it all down to, okay, this entire episode is built around the concept of abject terror, or this is about loss, or this is about consequence, you know, or what have you. And you can really boil it down to very, very simple mission statements that he sets out for on the episodes that he writes. It may do something different when you're looking at his creative control over other people's writing, but we'll get to that when we start talking about his stance as EP. What about the idea of, there's really no way, we've talked about this so much, but if we're talking about his legacy, we really have to address the fact that death has no permanence. And it's still to this day, I mean, as we're recording here during the break, waiting for the 2017 Christmas special to air, and we've just gotten the 11th hour revival of Bill Potts, it doesn't seem like we've really moved past that one criticism that has always sort of hung out there to some degree. Has he advanced at all, or is that just his MO, FFED?
Yeah. It almost seems as if this season he wanted to address that by lots of child murder.
Mm.
He was killing kids left and right in it, the early episodes of this part of the season. And I'm not sure that that's the best way to address that.
Mm. Yeah, might have taken a slightly different path.
One thing is it's effective. I mean, you know, you kill off a kid and you're like, okay, there are stakes in this game now. But yeah, unfortunately, that seems to be the only progress he's made, and that's not the permanence that we're seeking in this thing. It is, you know, he has gotten better to the point where it's like it's not just unnamed characters that are getting killed off and usually brought back anyway. There have been some poignant deaths and stuff, and yeah, a lot of them have been children, unfortunately, but it's not something that it seems he fully grasps, that, you know, you're allowed to kill off a character and let that be the end of it. He's always gotta put that band-aid on it for you. And it robs it of so much. I mean, we've talked about the exit of Rose Tyler at the end of series two and how utterly devastating that was. But then when you get her back and you give her the happy ending and you give her the chance to say goodbye, it's like, oh, well, that was nice. Took all the punch out of it, and now it's just some lackluster event in the show's history. But yeah, and unfortunately, most of the deaths of the Moffat era fit that same kind of thing.
Well, it's like, literally, Clara's revival in series 9 was almost in a much shorter window, was precisely the same sort of incident. I mean, by the time you get to Hellbent and you look at it, say, oh, okay, we're gonna do this again. Okay. Well, is this going to be nearly as effective as what we just went through with a gut wrench of Face the Raven? So, we discussed this. That definitely gave me pause. That we hadn't moved past that, and then it looked like we almost walked the precisely same path, or were walking the same path with Bill. Again, even a tighter window. So now we get a chance to meet Bill, and over the course of just a handful of episodes, she becomes near and dear to us because of her adventurousness, her curiosity, her willingness to remain optimistic and gung-ho and follow the Doctor in the adventures, not for the sake of the same sort of addiction to adventure that Clara had succumbed to, but just a matter of just this wide-eyed fascination with it. And then when we realize that we're losing her, that's all the more painful, I think, personally. I mean, I took Bill's potential demise much more to heart. And again, I know we're getting a little bit away from Moffat's writing. We're starting to drift right now into his controlling puppeteer strings as showrunner and executive producer. But again, it's a matter of, okay, please, we've gone through all of series 10 praising you for systematically going down the line and ticking off all the boxes of things that we had been critiquing you for to date. And it looks like you were really starting to get it. And then maybe not. We get yet one more door opening just at the end. And some people really enjoyed it. Some people said, good, I think that honors the character, the fact that she deserves better because she was a better person, and on and on and on. And other people said, no, you just can't do that. Again, you have to make death sting. So I don't know if that's ever going to leave us.
Well, and I think that leads us nicely into our next point, in that most of the time when Moffat writes, he is writing, he's aiming for the heartstrings. He wants to make you feel, and doesn't always stick the landing on logic and things like that. It may not make the most sense, but God knows it's effective in making you cry. But part of that is that he tends to write emotionally and doesn't look at it and say, well, you know, he doesn't give it the thought of saying, how would this be if I leave it this way? Or how would it's like, okay, this hurts, I need to make it better, kind of thing.
Better meaning make it hurt more.
Or, you know, hurt more in a different way of like, you know, well, that sucked.
Well, I mean, look at his Moffat really capitalized on the, if not capitalized, he may have just outright defined the era of speeches. So whether it's the, you know, Zygon inversion speech or the just kind speech or going back the Rings of Akaten or any of the ones where the Doctor's really starting to throw down. Rings of Akaten wasn't his. Sorry, that's a bad example. But he would revel in those because it would give him an opportunity to really, as we said, you know, go back to something basic. You know, really tear it down and give you that raw emotion, whatever that emotion is, whatever goal that he was aiming towards. He wanted it absolutely purified down to its, you know, down to its crystalline form, and we'd linger on it. So I think, If we're looking at his writing as something that, yes, it's calling towards the emotions, if not, you know, your sense of logic or reason, but then the other side of it is the fact that he likes to, he was constantly tinkering. I will give him that, that he was pushing the envelope, whether it was in the 50th anniversary where he was creating a new possible, you know, manifestation of the Doctor that completely sat outside of everything we understood, and was taking a huge gamble with that because he said, all right, I'm going to do something where I'm taking something that conceptually has never even been considered for the character, but I'm going to put a powerhouse actor behind it, and it's going to be of such a caliber that no one's even going to have the opportunity to complain about it, which you sort of did. You know, these are the kind of things that he would experiment with over the course of his tenure. And I don't know if you want to say that that's just immense risk-taking or if it's just a matter of he really was such a mastermind about it that, I mean, because we've heard the articles where he said, yeah, half the time when I was writing material for the 50th anniversary episode, I had five versions of the script going because I didn't really know what was going to work or what I was going to run with. But yet what we ended up being handed was really interesting, you know, even if it wasn't your particular cup of tea, it sure was a hell of an endeavor. So do we really credit him for being as risk-taking and as adventurous with the stories that he wrote? Or was it reckless?
Could it be both?
Why can't we have both? Well, I guess it's a matter of whether or not you can't write something that's going to satisfy everyone. So is it a matter of him looking at this as, if I'm going to capture an audience and really hold on to them and get them really invested, I've got to do something crazy? Or is it a matter of, or maybe him saying, well, the audience today is sort of oversaturated with all these potential influences of all these programs are watching, and the dramatic level is amped up to 11, so I've got to amp up to 11.5. And I got to do these crazy things just to hold your interest, because I can't let this be the same show it's been for 50 years.
Yeah, he definitely did some interesting things with the show. And I mean, as much as some people despised it, he really was able to bring the show from his childhood forward. You know, this was something that Davies really didn't try and do, too much. He tried to reinvent the show for a modern audience, whereas Moffat really tried to tie it into what came before. It was definitely a labor of love trying to say, hey, all this stuff that was real campy when I was growing up with it, it can be really cool if done right. Check this out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's what made it terrifying to us when we were kids. And if I cast it through a sort of a modern lens or modern filter, it can be, terrifying / exciting / adventurous / what have you, all over again. We just need to update it. Yeah, I agree with you, and I think you've said this to this effect before, Jay. If RTD was being credited for making it a modern popular icon again, that Moffat decided to work his machinations to make it a global force. And the only way to do that is to really find out what was holding the attention of audiences on a global level and adapt the show's focal points to that. So let's take that. If it's an idea of taking the show and blowing it up exponentially, we've sort of discussed, has the show moved at all away from being an inherently British program under Moffat's tenure? Is it less British than it was in under previous showrunners?
Yeah, I don't.
I think there were.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I think there was definitely a lot more set in America and elsewhere around the world. I don't remember too many of the classic era doing anything in America.
No. We've discussed that you get an occasional trip to New York City, top of the Empire State Building and things of that sort, but it wasn't nearly anything like Truth or Consequences.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I mean, that doesn't necessarily change what it is about. Like, that doesn't change the heart of the show. That's just the setting. I mean, how is setting it in, Bangladesh any different than some random alien planet? It's still not in England. So does that change the show and make it an alien thing? I think that Moffat was able to keep it a British show. He was able to keep it keep the heart of what the show was, but made it appeal to more audiences.
Okay. That idea of, as you started to allude to just a little while ago, Jay, about the dealing with the classic interests. I mean, we've known Moffat was a childhood admirer of the program and absorbed it with such ferocity, similar to Capaldi in that regard, that it was something that that he was always cognizant of what made the program such a fascination to him, and he so often wants to share that, wants to imbue that same sort of fascination with any viewer, new or longstanding. If that's one of his sort of principal drives, as far as I really want people to watch this program and from young ages and realize, okay, that it could be role models that they're picking up on, or it could be villains and enemies and monsters that stick with you and potentially haunt you in the wee hours of the night, or it's characters that you either want to emulate or that you want to, go play, pretend with your friends in the schoolyard the next day and that sort of thing. And he wants to keep that sort of youthful enthusiasm going. That's tricky to a certain point, because I think he's still one that is a strong proponent of referring to it. He still refers to it as a children's program. Mm-hmm. And I know we've had this conversation. Is it really a children's program? Maybe that was the original intent. Has it gotten away from that? Is it something that's supposed to be to serve all ages or what have you? But if he's still seeing it as such, the stuff he writes and the stuff he creates is a hell of a lot more bold than what you would normally anticipate for a children's program, depending on what the definition of where you decide to border that, you know, does children mean 12 to 18? Does children, you know? So where does he stand as far as his tenure, his legacy, as far as looking through that scope, the idea of this being a youth-oriented program? Has he done, I mean, RTD wrote some pretty bubblegum stuff. He put together a couple seasons of stuff that you would say is easily digestible by all ages, all audiences. Moffat was criticized quite a bit for going really dark, going really spooky, going really scary, going, you know, has he, in retrospect, I mean, do you think that he's sort of resolved that? Or are those legitimate statements and it's just, well, the audience has shifted?
I mean, how many stories have we heard from people about, you know, the hiding behind the couch, the, you know, being so terrified by the Daleks or the Cybermen that they would, you know, literally go and hide behind the sofa while the show was, but they still watched it. And that's, I think that's what Moffat is aiming for, is that, you know, teach the world or teach the kids that the world is a scary place, but that there are ways to resolve issues. It's not, hey, everything's going to be happy and fun. And, you know, he does really try and key in on that. So, I don't know. I feel like there are a few Moffat episodes that I won't let my kids watch just because I know my kids and I know that it would keep them up for days. Mm. But I don't think that that's a bad thing on the whole. I don't think that it means that he's damaging the show. It's just, I picked out a couple episodes that I think aren't appropriate for my kids at their ages. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But no, I think that it's a good thing for him to kind of try and squeeze those in there, and because that's what he's good at, and then allow the other writers to do the happy and the, you know, the goofball dinosaurs on a spaceship kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, while we credit him for being able to work well with the classics and being able to find ways to modernize them and make them engaging again, whether it be the anything from the from the villains that he chooses to do, to going back and giving just the little breadcrumb references to things that have happened within the classics, like we've had just within this past season. There's always the discussion of whether or not he's doing something that's a little bit too much of a reach, or that he's dipping too far into the classics. He's actually said that within the first couple of seasons, when he was at the helm, he was hesitant to do some of those classic references because he was being told by BBC execs that he was going a little bit too obscure, or that he would confuse the viewers because they wouldn't understand the frame of reference that he was trying to tip a hat to, no matter how overt or subtle he was doing it. And he got to a certain point, just I think within the last couple of years, where he realized that people were really sort of thriving on it and using it as a springboard to go and find out more about what happened in the past. Because obviously, everybody, you know, that rising tide raises all boats. So do you feel that he's struck a nice balance in doing that? Or, as some critics have said, he's trying too hard in his quest to be infinitely clever, to say, look how many of these little trivia I can fit in so that people can write listicles about all of the Easter eggs that I've stuffed into every episode I've written.
You know, there's a, like I said earlier, it's when RTD was at the helm, he envisioned the show as a restart, as, you know, basically a new version of the show that he watched when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. And he would hint at things that came before and things like that, but there was never any overt references to the classic era. The first time that we saw anything like that was in 11th Hour when the 11th Doctor is asking the Atraxi to look up you know, who defends the Earth? And you actually see all of the previous Doctors show up. And that is the first time that we have any reference to any of the classics, like any overt reference to that. And so, I mean, from the get-go, Moffat was trying to do that, say, hey, look, there is a vast history that this show has that, you know, if you're interested in it now, you can go back and find more stuff. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't something that you had to be a part of in order to enjoy the episodes. And as time went on, I think he strayed away from that a little bit. There was more, there were deeper pulls and there were more, niched references and things like that. And he always tried to keep it in a balance of, this is a great thing. If you want to know more, you can go back and find it, but it's not required for this episode.
Right.
And I think he's done a great job of that. Nobody has ever come up to me and been like, I didn't get at all what that episode was about. What's going on here? Like, it's clear that there is something they're referencing, but it's not required for you to get through. So I feel like he has tried to get a little too clever and tried to pull too many things in recently, just in the sense that it's starting to feel like pandering towards the end, where it's just, hey, I'm pulling stuff. I'm, you know, every episode there's something to the, but it's never to the detriment of the story.
Okay.
So I think that's the important thing.
Patrick, how would you see that balance as far as, like, all of a sudden, like we just had in this past series, all of a sudden the Movellans show up for a split second and they're sort of dismissed within a couple of lines. The Doctor has dealt with them before. They're not exactly friends. They're not exactly adversaries and so on. I mean, that sort of thing where we've gotten to.
I see it just like an Easter egg. I mean, it's not, as Jay said, it's not required viewing to understand what that means. It's, you could literally go through the whole episode and have no concept of what the history is. And it doesn't matter. But if you do, go, oh, look, I got something that was clever.
Right.
I don't see that being a problem.
No, I wouldn't consider, and I have to agree, I wouldn't consider it a problem as long as it can walk that fine line between being just a point of interest. There's something you can choose to pursue that rabbit hole if you want to, but since we've got 45 minutes to go in this episode, let's continue to run with the story. And if it nags at you later, you know, start Googling and pursue it from there. I will say though, he's, and this is one conversation that I know continues to go on, because if you make the mistake of reading the comments, never read the comments, but people talking about the complexity of his storylines and his story arcs. We'll have to say that, you know, RTD was very selective about the long game arcs that he chose to pursue, and he was very systematic about how he was going to approach them. He used them as a very surgical tool, whereas Moffat has been criticized as trying to figure out how many concurrent arcs, how many breadcrumbs, how many loose threads can he leave out there so that he can pursue things later, either as a result of for the purpose of him demonstrating his ability to spin multiple plates and keep all these things in flux, or because he personally finds that complexity level really fascinating, as you see in some of his other dramatic pursuits, whether it's Sherlock or anything else that he's done in the past. He likes to have a lot of these things going at once because he, as an audience member, finds that really interesting, really compelling, really engaging. Where do you gentlemen sit on the fence of it's interesting or it's overindulgent?
Personally, I enjoy the complexity. I think it brings almost like a Joss Whedon or like Babylon 5 did similar things where they're setting things up seasons ahead that don't pay off in any appreciable way for years. And then it goes, oh, I remember that.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. That is fun when done correctly. And it's a hard thing to do. And Moffat has accomplished it a number of times. There are some where it's fallen a little flat, but for the most part, yeah, he's able to know when the best time to spring that trap is. It's a very different storytelling technique than we had with Davies. Who, you know, he would have that one thing that you just got references to, like, you know, just one quick, you know, Vote Saxon poster on the wall. And that's all you get. You know, and then at the very end, you realize, oh, this was something he was setting up all along, but it's not, it wasn't something that you really have to go back and watch to see all of the various things that he sprinkled in there and whatnot. And it's just kind of, as you're watching through, you're like, hey, look, there's another reference to that.
Right. It didn't come with a lot of prerequisites.
Yeah.
So I guess the tipping point is, do you feel for the people that say, you know, and I've seen this with so many other series where they've gone through complex arcs. You could even take something as iconic as like the X-Files, where they say, are you a monster of the week kind of fan, or are you a conspiracy theory fan? And you really mm-hmm. want to see it all play out to the point where you almost feel rewarded as a viewer because you've walked the path and you get where all the pieces fall in because you've invested the time, the energy, and the analysis. And the payoff is, you know, however it resolves. Fringe is another one, you know, or go on and on and on.
Right.
So even aside from just the idea of the, like the Babylon 5, where you've got a line drop here that apparently was either the cueing point or the ending point for something that you don't get for five seasons, and you, oh, okay, well remembered on you. If you didn't get that, if you didn't remember that, does it necessarily change your enjoyment of the episode itself? It kind of goes back to what we were just saying earlier about the whole idea of Easter eggs. If you pick up on it, oh, it's a classic reference. Awesome. Wow, that's really cool. He's really doing a deep pull on that one. That's 1972. Nice job. But if you have no idea what he's talking about and the episode's still engaging, how the hell with it? Move on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the danger in that is kind of alienating the audience that that doesn't get the reference. Mm-hmm. If you make it to where, and it's, like I said, it's a hard balance to pull where it's, you know, trying to say, hey, you figured this out. Congratulations. You know, here's your token enjoyment for the episode. But on the other side of that, do you have the people that don't figure it out? You have to be able to have them still enjoy the episode and be like, wow, that was kind of clever. I wish I'd seen it sooner, whatever, without making them feel like, hey, guess what, idiot? You completely missed the point of the episode.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess that kind of goes back to my question. Do you feel that he's done an admirable job of walking that line, or is he batting like 500 at this point? And we've had as many instances where you feel that it has required additional background research, or it breaks away from being a serial, you know, into something that requires long term investment. Because I don't think the original intent. Or a lot of the long-standing intent, either during the classic era or even under Davies's tenure, that it required a lot of committed linear viewing.
Yeah, no, it's. I think that he's done an admirable job about it. There have been a couple missteps or whatnot, but for the most part, I feel like he's done a good job of tying it all together and not alienating anyone. It's kind of a mixed bag sometimes because I mean, I'm not exactly one to say where people might fall through the cracks or whatever, but, I haven't heard too many people, you know, saying that they couldn't enjoy it because they didn't get the reference or anything like that. So it's
no, the only way that I've seen it phrased, but I have seen it on multiple occasions. Granted, I'm not going to put any kind of a percentage on it or anything of that sort. But as far as reading the comments, you get people that say, I can't enjoy these anymore because it feels like work to watch. And I just want a fun story that wraps itself up after 52 minutes, you know, and maybe some scary stuff happens or maybe some sad stuff happens. And that's all fine. That goes along with the nature of any dramatic program. But I don't want to feel like I get to the end of it and either I feel like I missed something because 3 weeks ago I missed the episode because my gram was over, or I get to the end of an episode and I'm being told that this was the first of three parts and now I'm locked in to making plans for the next couple of weeks just to find out how this resolves.
I think you had referenced X-Files earlier, mm-hmm. and I think that they did a good balance of the major overarching story and the Monster of the Week episodes. I think he tried to do that a few times and to varying degrees of success, where the Monster of the Week episodes could just be self-contained and you could just get that one episode of fluff mm-hmm. that didn't matter in the greater, you know, storyline. I'm not sure he did that well, balancing it.
The problem that I have with those episodes, with the Monster of the Week that didn't really tie into anything, was that he rarely ever allowed them to be just that. They're usually at the end had to be that little button to right. tie it into the rest of the story. And I honestly, the one that stands out the most is the Crimson Horror, where, you know, you got an episode that had nothing to do with anything else. And then at the end, they had to cram on the two kids making it obnoxious. And it ruined the entire episode, at least for me. I know there's some people that really enjoy it, but I can't go back and watch it just because it left such a bad taste in my mouth. So you have to, when you do the fluff episodes or the fillers that aren't going to progress the overall storyline, you have to allow them to be just that or masterfully work them in. And unfortunately, Moffat can't do that. He has to tag on something.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, we dealt with that entire thing with the Missy reveal. You know, how many times did we get those little hints of the Nether Sphere and we kept wondering who Scary Poppins was and went on with it. And when we finally got a chance to get a fuller understanding of who Missy was, even before like the actual kind of reveal of who she really was, but just having more screen time with her and letting the character get fleshed out a little bit more, it was such a great reward. And she's become such a fascinating character and an addition to the Pantheon. But those little codas that we kept getting that were so disjointed, they were fascinating, but at the same time aggravating.
Right.
So I don't know that he had ever really gotten that, you know, sort of worked in the way he really wanted them to gel. This time around, as we were getting it, I think in this past season, with the whole idea of I can only kind of refer to it as the tier concept that kept kind of running through, had us all thrown. I was not prepared. I had no inclination that the whole, you know, your tiers or someone else's sort of thing was going to be the carry through that was going to get us to Bill's saving grace come the series finale. But again, that wasn't necessary. That wasn't the idea of having some weird thing stuck on the end. And it wasn't like we were getting little moments of John Sim in costume, you know, laughing right before we go to credits or something of that sort. So he broke away from that. Maybe it was lesson learned, or maybe it was just a matter of him saying, you know, I'm not working the same kind of angle, so I'm not gonna follow that same sort of technique. But this time around, the whole idea of taking something where you don't realize how often I gave you clues as to what's really going on. I enjoy that personally much more as a viewer. I think this last season he really honed that to a great razor sharp point in saying, and he joked about it in interviews. He was taunting the audience, saying, no, you've been given the answer many times now and you don't see it yet. And he finger steepling through the entire thing. I think he did an excellent job. Sure, there are dissenters who said, no, that's a cop-out, you know, oh, save the world with love, blah, 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 what have you. But I think this was a great execution of that sort of a long arc that didn't in any way feel like an arc.
Yeah, and I think that this Series 10 is definitely a standout for people that want to defend Moffat's ability to do this. He really did do a great job with this one, because it wasn't something that he had to shove in your face. He just allowed it to be the story that it was without reminding you, hey, I've got this overarching thing. Are you paying attention? Because I've got this whole thing going on. He just allowed it to be the story that it needed to be without shoving it down anybody's throat.
I guess One of the last points that I want to sort of take apart here, because of the fact that he's done so much, he's introduced characters, villains, story concepts that could never be equated with anyone else but coming from his creative mind, whether it's the Weeping Angels, whether it's Missy, whether it's the idea of the Impossible Girl, whether it's River Song or anything that he's done to bring back the Ice Warriors or things of that sort that he's provided the program, move the needle forward with the Time War, bringing it almost up to the moment, bringing Gallifrey back somehow, maybe, don't really know where it stands, still sort of a kind of a limbo topic, toying around with the Doctor's childhood. I mean, all of these things that he's played around with in his quest to see where is the next layer of this that we can peel back and find out more about this show that has constantly sort of redefined itself, but at the same, it's built on so much unknown that you have to be very careful about how much of that you want to actually fill in. You know, how cloudy do you leave certain core tenets of the story versus how much do you want to say, wow, you really want to blow some minds, show the Doctor as an 8-year-old or something of that sort, or show Davros as an 8-year-old, you know, and that kind of thing. So he's walking away from this and handing the keys to the kingdom to Chris Chibnall and tipping his hat to Jodie Whittaker on his way out the door. What do you feel he's doing to the good or to the negative with the way that he's wrapping things up? Meaning, you know, exactly as we stand, not knowing where the Christmas episode is falling. Do you see more opportunity or more closure in what he's leaving behind him as he walks out of the room?
Badger, what do you think about this?
First thing I think of is Missy. He created a very interesting version of the Master. Certainly nothing like we've seen before. And where do we go from here? Obviously, you know, the Master has never successfully been killed, so I'm pretty sure she'll get out of this somehow. Mm. And Chibnall's Master may not be, the same character, obviously, but it's interesting that he has managed to create this, his own kind of versions of these characters that have gone with him. You know, we're not going to see Missy ever again.
Yes, true.
Or River.
River was another one that was spectacular from the beginning. And
what do you feel about the argument where people are saying that the idea of the work with River and Missy's characters were really a matter of him experimenting, testing the waters to see where he could go with female characters, and now he's handing this over because he wasn't ready personally to make the jump to a female Doctor, wanting it to happen but not feeling the time was right, so he was sort of moving the agenda forward. Now that that's done, now that he was probably involved to some degree in conversation with Chibnall about the casting, I'm sure he was at least not necessarily asked, but maybe in some way consulted with about the casting. Suppositional, but so let's say that Chibnall decides to put the Master, Missy, Master character aside for a full season. Say, you know, we need a break. I've got some stories, some things I want to move forward. There's some things I want to establish. And last thing I need is people wondering, you know, who's going to replace Michelle Gomez. So, and then everybody else saying, well, God, well, River Song, you know, she's talking about, you know, her husband and all his legacy and all of the faces. And was she not cognizant of this? How are you going to resolve that? Maybe he's not going to. Maybe he's going to leave all these things alone and we won't even get name checks. So what does this do for him? Meaning, what does this do for Chibnall as far as his, is this a freeing aspect to say you no longer have to worry about these sort of things? Or is it a bit shackling in saying you can't use these characters that have become such icons to the program to date, and now you have to establish something entirely on your own? So lots of luck to you.
Yeah, I think that it is more of a case of a clean slate. Moffat, I mean, a lot of people think that he made a huge mess during his tenure, and yet he managed at the end to sweep it all up and leave it relatively, relatively clean. He took a lot of different storylines, a lot of different loose threads, and the vast majority of them are tied up and cleaned away, and there's nothing that Chibnall has to worry about tying into the overall tapestry because it's already been done. It might be, I don't think it's so much restricting, because you can't look at a blank page and be like, well, I've got nothing to work with here. There's not, what am I supposed to do as a writer? He's got storylines in his head, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he doesn't have to build off of something somebody else did is probably freeing. Whether or not that's something that fans want to deal with, that's another question, because our Haley herself is a huge fan of River Song. We've all enjoyed Missy. You know, there are these characters that we've fallen in love with that we want to see again, but that's the nature of the show, is that people come and go, the companions, the doctors, everybody has their time and then has to exit. Mm-hmm. So Chibnall might catch some flack for not including, you know, somebody's favorite character, but as a writer, I think that he is probably excited for the chance to take this property that is globally known and adored and put his own twist on it without any preconceptions.
Mm. Well, I look at Captain Jack. Mm-hmm. You know, you've still got people clamoring, wanting to know when the character is going to return. You do realize you went through an entire tenure of a showrunner and did not have any screen time, not even a... Do we even have a name check? We had one, I think. Oh. But it's a character that was boxed. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of, do you continue to work with the game pieces that were there the last time someone played, or do you now look at the state of the board and say, okay, now I have new moves to make? Badger, where would you fall? I mean, as far as do you think that that Moffat has opened opportunities for Chibnall as a primary, well, showrunner is going to be a little different because we don't really know whether he's going to be doing the writing room format or whether he's going to be sort of, you know, just the overseeing eye. So opening doors or closing them?
I think a little both. Missy and River, we see the beginning and their ends. You know, those are beloved characters and they're pretty much played out. I mean, they're not in a bad way, but we see every bit of their arc. They're not going to be back. Maybe they'll get referenced, maybe not. It's a blank slate, as Jay said, and that's very freeing for a writer. We'll see where that goes. I don't know. As far as Captain Jack, I mean, there's things about the time agents. We don't really know a lot about them. Mm-hmm. That could be interesting to delve into. Maybe about him, maybe not. Torchwood, I think we've pretty much seen all we're going to see of Torchwood.
I'm kind of okay with that.
So I think we're all... You know, we don't know where it's going to go after Christmas, but I think we've got a blank slate ahead of us.
I do like the fact that Gallifrey is back in play, because I think knowing Chibnall's writing, knowing some of the things that he's been able to sort of really sink his teeth into, he could really, if he wanted to get, you know, sort of stray a little bit from sort of the common fare sci-fi and get into something that's more of sort of, well, he could even to a certain degree sort of go space opera with a little bit and get into some, you know, some political haranguing and things of that sort. It could be kind of interesting too for a little while, as long as it's done in kind of, you know, digestible doses and doesn't really become the premise of the show for a while. But having that back in play is definitely interesting. I still want to know, And again, we're not going to sort of drift into spoiler territory, but I still want to know what's going on with the restaurant at the end of the universe that's still winging around there somewhere. I think that answer still, or that where that still stands sucks and needs a little bit more to call it done. I still think that Bill disappearing into the ether with Heather is a little incomplete. And I don't really know if they can do anything with that either. But that's the nature of it. I mean, you've got so many concurrent storylines, and he loves to leave so many loose threads, either for himself or someone else to be able to pull upon later, that it gets a little overwhelming at times. I don't think it's necessarily a negative, but if you add them all up, there's a lot of material still out there that has been set in motion that we're just supposed to just pay attention to what's shining in front of you right now. You know, let me distract you with this right now, because if you really try to tally it at the end of the day, you'd be sort of upset with how much is unresolved. But there may be a method to that madness, I suppose. For this very reason, to give the next showrunner to sit in the chair the opportunity to do whatever the hell they want, pursue the ones they want to, and if it's not, it becomes kind of like a Captain Jack thing where, you know, oh, he could come back. Oh, you just sit there and wonder. I'm not sure.
So on the whole, I mean, I know we've got the one more episode, the Christmas special going on, but on the whole, how do you guys feel about Moffat's tenure? Is it something that, you know, that we'll look back on fondly and remember the good old days when Moffat was in the chair? Or is it a case of, you know, good riddance, see you later, you know, thanks for ruining my childhood or whatever? Or is it just a kind of middle of the road, like, hey, this was fun, but it's definitely time for you to go?
Badge, you want to take first crack at this?
I see his tenure as a showrunner kind of a mixed bag. His writing, of course, is impeccable. Some of the best episodes were written by him. I don't know, trying to force things into his structure kind of made things a little uncomfortable here and there, and a lot of things didn't work. But overall, I think he's done the show a good service.
I have to agree. I mean, I think I might spin it a little more positively just because of the fact that I think that we've been handed some things that I think have definitely moved the program forward in admirable directions, taken some risks that have really paid off as far as opening up opportunities, really engaging the audience and getting them really discussing the show at a whole new level of interest and investment. So as far as ensuring the lifeblood of the program, I think he's done an exceptional job in doing so with an amount of controversy and difficulty along the way that I think is in a way necessary. I think to a certain degree, if it were something where it was just easily digestible and it was just cotton candy and you just suck it down every week and nobody really had any issues with it, then it would get really formulaic after a while and would sort of lose people's interest either just through boredom or just a feeling of I'm not gaining anything nutritionally from this. So getting the occasional indigestion actually reminds you of the fact that getting invested in the program can be a bit of work at times, and has its benefits of doing so. It engages conversation. It gets people really sort of debating and hashing points out. It gives us fodder for con panels and so forth, you know, and that kind of thing. But it's the nature of, okay, it's definitely not stagnant. And that's absolutely something I'll say, that for his tenure, it was always a matter of, even if you didn't like what was going on, very few people threw up their hands. I'm not going to say no one, but very few people threw up their hands and walked away from it and said, I'm not coming back to this program. I absolutely hate where it's going. People would stay in just to hate watch. Sure. Go ahead. I'm guilty. I've done the same thing. Not with this particular series, but I've done the same thing. It would give them something where they would be just as invested to be able to say, nah, he's off his nut. He's doing this, that, the other thing, and it's ruining the program. But they were still there week after week. And I'm willing to guarantee that even those people that were some of the staunchest adversaries and you know, the He-Man Moffat haters clubs would still say, okay, but there was this. There was this other thing. Okay, Weeping Angels. Yeah, you got me on that one. And so on and so on. And you can't take that away from them.
Yeah, it's if nothing else, I mean, there are plenty of arguments to be had about his writing style or things he's done with the show or whatever the case is. But if for no other reason, I will always look fondly back on the Moffat era, simply because I've gone from in the 5 years that we've done this podcast, I've gone from, hey, have you ever heard about Dr. Show? It's this kitschy little British show about it, that to walking down the street and hearing people have a conversation as I pass them. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has become a powerhouse in geekdom. And that's in no small part thanks to Stephen Moffat. because he really did take it from this little British show that, you know, you would have to search out in order to find it, to one of the most popular sci-fi shows in the world. Mm-hmm. So I will always fall on the side of Moffat, if for no other reason, just what he has done for the show.
For the good of the program. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess looking forward to what that does for the next era, that idea of saying, all right, I've handed you something that is running at its absolute full tilt right now. You can choose to do whatever you want with it. It may be very freeing, but it's also an immense responsibility. I do not envy what Chris Chibnall is walking into in the slightest, because it will not take more than 10 minutes of screen time for them to decide whether or not he has any idea what he's doing. It's going to be a very, very tetchy Christmas episode 2018 when we get the first frames with him at the helm. It's no wonder why he really wants to stay out of the public eye. I keep seeing all these articles where they're talking about some, they're theorizing about some stuff with Chibnall, and they always have that one stock photo of him in that maroon jacket because he just does not want to do these public engagements, and they just don't have enough stock photography of this poor man. He just I've got things to do. Can I please just sit in my office? I've got things to write. I have a lot of things on my plate right now. But I have something that I want to kind of throw out, not only to the two of you gentlemen, but to the listening audience at large. Can you indulge me for a second?
Sure.
So one of the conventions that's near and dear to us, obviously, if you've been listening to us at all over the course of the, as Jay said, we just passed our fifth anniversary since episode one of GPR, Please Don't Listen to It, ever dropped. and that's Long Island Who, or L.I. Who, now coming into its fifth year, oddly enough, running in tandem with us here. But they've opened up their opportunity for panel suggestions. They're going to start to load their schedule. And we always try to make sure that we have a couple of different things on the docket, working with Ken and Billy and the rest of the squad over there as laying out the programs. We want to know, because we do have a good number of listeners who attend the con with us every year, growing in numbers year after year, and it's been great to see you all there and have you in the live cast and those things. We'll definitely make sure that we try to get in for another live cast as well. We're going to try to make it a little more game-oriented this year, get some ideas for some things. We've been testing a few on you over the past couple of months. But there are also, some of the best discussions that we've had have been on topics that we never knew were really going to blow up as much as they were. And that was because of listener engagement. And that was some of the feedback that we were getting from you. So please, we want to do this in a timely fashion. We want to try to get materials back into the administrative team over at LI Who as quickly as possible. So consider this an immediate call to action. For listeners, if you have ideas for panels that you personally would like to be a part of, whether you were sitting up in the dais or whether you were in the audience chatting with us, or we were sitting out in the audience with you and we're muttering and poking each other in the elbow and say, what do you think of this guy? What do you think of this thing? What do you think of that? Whatever it is, get them out to us and get vocal with us, because we want to make sure that we've got material on the roster that is as engaging to you as it is to us, because we'll talk up a blue streak about Alpha Centauri for 45 minutes, but that's just us. We want to know what's got your ear and got your attention as well. So all the different methods, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or email or voicemail. God, when was the last time we got a good voicemail?
Jeez, I don't know.
That thing's still running, right? I have to
double check on that.
There's probably a bunch of robocalls about paying off our student debt loans and things of that sort. But yes, please do reach out to us so that we can get some ideas for panels on there that you want to be a part of as well, because it's all about the conversation. So, please. And the clock's ticking on that. Not to make any stupid time puns, but yeah, clock's ticking.
Yeah. Don't want to stress you out, but do it now.
Oh, God. What are you taking so long? Just stop. Turn off the podcast now and start composing an email, please.
Yeah. But I think it's about time for us to talk about some news.
Let's be newsworthy. Let's take just a moment, as the rest of the Whovian community has over the course of the past week, to remember the loss of Victor Pemberton. For those who do not recognize him by name and the legacy that he has established for Doctor Who, going back to the Second Doctor's era, one of the principal writers for a number of episodes, actually even played a couple of bit roles, one of the select few people who got a chance to actually play some characters. He was in the moon base as one of the scientists involved in that story. But at the same time, he was also responsible for being a writer and editor on episodes like Fury from the Deep and the Tomb of the Cybermen. So he is actually the gentleman responsible for the creation of the sonic screwdriver. We lost him this last week at the age of 85. He actually outlived his partner, Peter Bryant, who was also involved in the Troughton era. Story editor, also played some bit characters in the Cybermen episodes. So a considerable loss to the Whovian community in that regard. So he's very finally missed. Fraser Hines had a wonderful couple of things to say about him after hearing the news of losing. Use it as an opportunity if you're not as familiar with some of the workings behind the scenes for the writing and the editing, especially during those pivotal formative years, to learn about what Victor had done for the program. So definitely missed. On a little bit of a lighter note, we'll let people know since we continue to get little stories about Jodie Whittaker and the lead up to her casting announcement. I found this kind of humorous, really not news breaking, but just good to know that this is just like any other household. If you had a family secret, or if you had a secret that you felt it was something that just had to be told to someone, and you're close with your family, you know your family members well, who would you trust with it? Who would you not trust with it? We all know in our households. Apparently, Jodie's household is no different when it comes to her parents. I believe they're still in the Yorkshire area where she's from. Shared it with her mom. And
kept
spoke
a secret from her dad.
Yeah, kept a secret from her dad. Spoke in code about it. And I wish I want to know the backstory is the fact that whenever she had to be on the phone with her agent, she had to refer to the role or the casting decision as the Clooney. What does that mean? I mean, when you pick, like, it's like watching one of these spy movies where they say, all right, well, my spy name for this thing is going to be Elephant or what have you, or Pachyderm. But the Clooney? So that her dad wouldn't figure it out because he can't keep a secret to save his life? That's going to have to be an interview question later on. If we ever get a chance to ever speak with Jodie, we have to find out why was it referred to as the Clooney.
Yeah, she went on to say it was like a full military operation. Basically whispered for 3 months and it was tedious even in my own kitchen. So it's but one of the interesting stories that kind of came along with this, I guess. So there were like four people who knew about her casting. One of those was Matt Smith.
Why put him on the inside track?
I don't know.
Probably because of the Clooney.
Exactly. But he spoke recently at a convention he was at and told the audience how he, when he found out that she had been cast, he called her and, you know, she didn't answer the phone, weird number, you know, whatever. It went to voicemail and he proceeded to sing the Doctor Who theme song onto her voicemail, went through the entire thing. And at the very end said, it's Matt, call me.
Obscure enough.
Yeah. So it's
because there's only one Matt, apparently.
Well, you know.
Unless she could hear the flappy hands in the background and could put two and two together.
Well, you know, feet have a certain kind of feet faces kind of
guy.
Since we're not entirely done with Matt Smith, because we're never entirely done with Matt Smith.
No.
Their con circuits have been getting fast and furious. We're in the midst of con season, so everybody's showing up everywhere. I'm so glad we're seeing so many of these people, especially Mr. Capaldi, who's doing a lot more con appearances and can continue to do so for the end till the end of time, and we have no problem with that whatsoever. But we will note that I think it was just sort of pieced together between Jenna Coleman and Matt Smith, that as a result of some of their most recent projects, specifically The Crown, that Matt has been portraying Prince Philip, and Jenna Louise Coleman's role as Queen Victoria in Victoria on ITV, that they sat there and figured out by lineage that would mean that Jenna is officially a great, great grandmother to Matt Smith?
I believe so. It's the great great grandmother.
She looks fantastic for her age.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but these are the sort of things that time travelers ponder, I suppose.
Yeah, and I mean, both of these stories I adore simply because it proves that the Doctor Who cast is a family, regardless of who you're on the show with or how long it's been since you've been on the show, or what. These people are all part of a very, very exclusive club, and they keep in touch with each other. And it's nice to see that kind of relationship continue between people that you admire. So it's just kind of fun to know that they enjoy each other just as much as we enjoy them.
And we've seen that from all the, even with this transition into a new cast and crew, all the messages and the statements made about welcoming them in and saying, you know, oh, you're in for a fantastic ride. We're here for you with advice and what have you, or the positive messages or encouragement or little things that they've been passing along, which I'm sure we'll get more of as the weeks and months proceed, because we're going to continue to ask them because we need something to hold us over. But it's always great to see. You have to. I mean, we've got something with a legacy this long, and so many people involved with it. They're asking somebody who hasn't been in the program since 1965, and you're asking them their thoughts on something that's happening in 2017. It's just it's an amazing circle to see completed.
Absolutely. But that's all the news that we've got for this week. So next week, we'll be returning to our classic rewatch and taking a look at the Day of the Daleks.
Yes. So this is Joe Grant's first encounter with the Daleks. It's actually, this is a divisive story. And I'm not going to go into that further because I want to see Haley clunk her way through this and figure out exactly what the heck she's witnessing. And we'll leave it at that. So please, for those of you listening in, grab your DVDs or head off to your library or grab your BritBox or whatever you need to, and get yourself through the story so that you can share it with us in a week's time. But Badger, thank you so much for spending the evening chatting with us about this. I appreciate the time.
No problem. Anytime.
We will definitely take you up on that.
This has been episode 247 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I am so clever. Look at how clever I am. I tied things together like a big boy.
Wow, that wasn't condescending at all. Just spent an hour and 10 minutes being positive about this poor man, and then you go and poop on his cornflakes. Well, this is Kier saying, of the fan base, by the fan base, for the fan base. Mr. Moffat, thank you for your work.
We'll see you guys next week.
Allons-y.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to gunnageek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Couldn't leave it alone, could you?
No, I couldn't.
I'm a big boy now.